live from the Third Coast. It is our time to focus on where genealogy and spirit connect, a time to focus on our connection with ourselves and our past. Here's your host, Susan E. King.
Oh, good day, everybody. It's Tuesday down here near the island. Let me say that. We've got a few thunder boomers floating around, little leftovers from Tropical Storm Bonnie, I think is what it was. It didn't quite fizzle out, but, you know, they kind of leave their remnants around, just like some of our ancestors do. Don't ask me how I led into that, but I'm glad to be back. It's been several weeks, I think, since we've been live, and we've been busy, and we've had a lot of things going on. And I think today's guest is going to, kind of an indication of some of the things that we have going on. But, you know, I wanted to start off today about talking about genealogy just one more time. It's obviously my passion. And, you know, when we talk about genealogy, we don't really talk about it as so focused on just our own ancestors. But, you know, we focus on people because every person has a life and every life has a purpose. And also, too, every time has a purpose. And as we study genealogy and we study our roots and we study the history of other people, we really begin to learn a lot more about where we came from and the things that happened during our lifetimes and during the lifetimes of those that came before us. And some of those times and things and situations that we have learned to live with through our lifetimes, we're not always very pretty. You know, we have some of the situations going on today that are not very pretty. And, you know, a lot of it has to do with how we treat each other and we treat each other as people. And, you know, that is where I feel the spirituality comes in, is that, you know, every life is important. Every life has meaning. So, you know, it's very important that we understand that and that we understand ourselves and others through the study of self, which I believe is what genealogy is all about. But, you know, when we go back and we study things like the Holocaust, for example, you know, we look at that as some of the darkest days on our planet. Terribly frightening for people. It was terribly disruptive. Family units were totally exonerated and people were separated and left to die in very, very, very horrible, horrible ways. But, you know, when we also talk about the Holocaust, too, we can also talk about it in a different life, and light is what I meant. And that is in the light of life and hope. And there were people during the course of these terrible times that really did give life and hope to many people. And one such person actually risked everything he had and didn't pull out any stops to save lives during the period that we're going to talk about. And that particular man's name was Oscar Schindler, and most of you have heard of his name because of Steven Spielberg's famous movie called Schindler's List. And as well as that, the book that we're going to be discussing today is the book that's on its way out the door that's called Oscar Schindler, Stepping Stone to Life. And our guest is the author of that book, and his name is Dr. Robin O'Neill. And Robin is really very well known as for his scholarly work, and well known as one of the experts on Holocaust studies in the world. And he comes to us live from UK, and I want to welcome him. Robin, how are you?
Very well, Susan. It's very nice to speak to you again. I think the last time we met was in Lvov in Ukraine, probably about 10 years ago.
Yes, it was. And we did make some trips around some very special places during that time when we were there. The place was totally different than it was during the period of time that you studied. But it was one of those wonderful trips that I don't think I'll ever forget. Robin, I want to ask you a question, and I think that the audience would be really interested to know. I mean, your background is, as a former police officer or police investigator with Scotland Yard. And obviously you have the investigative skills, but why in the world did you change from being an investigator like that into a Holocaust scholar?
It's a long story, but I'll try and explain it in the best way I can. It goes back to the early 1970s when I was investigating a fraud case, and I had the occasion to arrest a Jewish man in London, and he committed a fraud. I think it must have been about a million pounds or perhaps $2 million. Although he was a criminal, he was decent enough, and we sat talking in the office, and I was getting his background from him, and he was telling me that he originated in Kolomia in southern Poland, and then he told me the dreadful story of how in 1941, June 41, when the Germans invaded the Soviet district, he fled to Kiev, and he stayed there under an assumed name until the war finished, and he returned to Kolomia to find that 37 of his family had been murdered by the Germans in various places, the forests, the Janowska camp, and especially the death camp at Belzec. But having said that, I got on very well with him, and eventually he went to court, and he pleaded guilty, and he got sentenced to 5 years imprisonment. And although we were on different sides, I became quite friendly with him, and he used to send me Christmas cards at Christmas time. But unfortunately, about 2 years after his sentence, he died suddenly, and there was no problem with that. It was just natural causes. And I thought, well, it's such a calamity for him, and I'd promised him that I would do what I could to try and trace the people that were responsible for his family's death. And I must say that after many years now, I failed. And but the next best thing was that I would write this book on Belzec, which is my first book, which was Stepping Stone to Genocide, in his honour, really. And and that's really what the position is. The book, the Belzec book, of course, runs very closely to the Schindler book, which is I've just finished, because the proximity of Belzec and Schindler's Krakow are so very close. And, of course, a lot of the Schindler people, or certainly the families, the ones that didn't survive, were all taken to Belzec. So we're looking at two periods in history brought together and explained as the best way I can. Does that help you with an explanation?
It's very fascinating. So from that one story and that one need to help and to do something for someone else, you got a master's degree and a doctorate degree and really moved on into a whole new field for you, correct?
Yes. In fact, my early years, I'm talking of my school time, I'm ashamed to say I never learned much, really. I was always playing sport, and I left school at 15 years with no qualifications, but I did acquire an urge to research history, and I'll tell you briefly how that came about. We had a temporary school teacher, and his name I can remember now. In fact, I think of him very often. His name was William Foskett Mumford, and he was an elderly gentleman, grey hair, glasses, and he taught us for a term because our normal form teacher was ill, and he introduced to me researching local history, which was in my area, and that switched on a light. It was amazing, and I just couldn't learn enough about it. And really, that was the start of my focus on historical things. And it wasn't really until the 70s, after having dealt with the criminal aspect of this man, that I decided to go to Poland and really make an exploratory research project and see how the Holocaust had happened. And so I did, and that was in, as I say, about 1975, 74, 75, about the same time, as a matter of fact, that I read in the paper about Oskar Schindler, because he died in Germany and had been taken back to Israel, and the two avenues of inquiry really came together. But my first visit back to Poland was to Belzec to find out the source of this man's anguish, the family, where they'd finished up. And it was then that I really realized what a significant, horrendous time it was during those awful years. And that's my start, really. And I'm afraid it never stopped then. And it carried on until about 1987. I mean, I was still a family man with two young children, and I was still doing my police work, etc. And the towns and names of places in Galicia, East and West Galicia, didn't really mean a thing to me. And the Kolomaya aspect of it, and then Krakow, and the Tarnów, and Bochnia, and Rawa Ruska, all these names started gradually come back. And about 1987, I saw a copy of Tom Keneally's book in a charity shop, and I picked it up for about 10p or 10 cents, I suppose, in your values. And I just couldn't believe what I was reading. And I thought, well, this is extraordinary. Firstly, I'd really come to the decision that I was going to, for the sake of justice, I was going to try and find out about the perpetrators of this man's family. This was the first thing, which I've done, and that's recorded in the Belzec's book, Stepping Stone to Genocide. But now I really got interested in Schindler because they were so connected in many ways that I made another visit to Poland. I went back to Poland in 1989 and really started from where Schindler operated from, and that was in the Amalia factory in Lipowa Street in Krakow. And my whole life was spinning out of control because I got so interested in the subject, in trying to seek justice for everybody, that it really took over my life. And it really, I've been trying to wind down a bit, but I'm having a lot of difficulty. So that really was the basis of the beginnings. One thing led to another, and I landed up in doing this in Poland. And finally, I think we've got something which we can be proud of doing, in satisfying that we did our best to find out the origination of all these terrible massacres.
You know, it's really amazing how we and you too, Robin, can become so impassioned on subjects that become of interest to us. And like in your case, I mean, you know, you never dreamt in a million years, probably, when you were interviewing this man for a fraud, that it would change your whole life. And
you're quite right, and it did. I mean, we're talking 30, 40 years now. But Schindler, as far as I'm concerned, has got a lot to answer for from my personal point of view, because when I went there full of hopes and, you know, to focus on his early life, my first visit to the Amalia factory, I was arrested by the... I didn't realise it, but it was a, one of these Warsaw Pact telecommunications places which had taken over the old Schindler factory, and there were posters all round, no photographers and what have you. And you must realise, of course, that it was during the Cold War, and, you know, foreigners creeping about with cameras in Poland at that time was treated with the greatest suspicion, and... I happened to be just walking by the place, and I took a couple of photographs, and out came several guards, I suppose, and you'd call them, and they bundled me off into an office where I was detained for several hours. And because although I speak Russian, I don't speak Polish, and I didn't want them to know that I spoke Russian, they then transferred me to the local police station, where I was put in the cell block, and I waited there for an hour or 2 hours. Nobody came to see me. Nobody tried to come and find out what I was doing there. But an interesting thing at that point was on the wall of the cell was a photograph, or quite a large photograph, of the present government of Poland. And I can't think of his name offhand, but the Prime Minister... I do know was a Polish Jew, and written, scrawled across his face was the word Juden. And I thought, well, if that's going on now still in 1989 Poland, they haven't learned very much from history. But eventually I was collected up by some plainclothes people, which I thought, because bear in mind that I was one of them, but from a different country, and it was quite interesting to really see how they operated, and I wasn't really impressed. But they took me again to the headquarters of the Krakow District Police headquarters, and I could see it was headquarters because there were various antenna and discs on the dishes and that on the top of the building. And there I sat there being interrogated. They seized my camera and all sorts of things. And the odd thing was that they couldn't communicate with me, and they were on the phone for a very long time trying to, obviously trying to get an interpreter, because here they've got a supposed spy had come into their country and was, you know, taking photographs of a forbidden area. And eventually, I think they got a bit fed up with it. But I sat back there and I smoked my pipe in the corner, and I was reading Tom Keneally's book about Schindler, and there was a map there, and it showed the Amalia factory, which was now this high-tech communist establishment. And I think they realised that they weren't getting anywhere, and so they took me down to the ground floor, and they kicked me out the door virtually. So I had to make my way back to Krakow, and I moved hotels as quick as I could, and I got away from their clutches. But that was my first introduction to Oscar, and I realised then that research is fine. But when you go to places like that, you've got to be very, very careful. And that was a very good lesson to me. But I survived. And oddly enough, I went back there. I took a group people to Krakow. It must have been about 3 years ago. And I was showing them the Amalia factory where Schindler worked and what have you. And... surprise, surprise, the man at the door was the very man who had arrested me back in 1989. And his name was Mitek. And
history repeats itself, doesn't it?
And we were very good friends. And we had our photographs taken together, and everybody knew the story. And he said he was very, very sorry and all this and that and the other. But that was Oscar. That was my introduction. And that was life, and that was what it was about.
And let's talk about the Oscar Schindler story. I think that, you know, most people are aware of it through the film that I mentioned early on in the show. But you've been researching this. I mean, you've met with his wife. I mean, you've interviewed people all over the world. And, you know, he was a pretty interesting individual, wasn't he?
Yes, he was extraordinary. He was, how can I put it, he was probably, he was a Nazi, there's no doubt about that. I mean, everybody joined the Nazi party, everybody in the National Socialist Workers' Party. If you didn't join, you didn't get paid and you couldn't draw a pension, you didn't get a job as a school teacher, you couldn't get a job in government. So everybody had to really toe the line and become a member of the Nazi party. So being a Nazi doesn't say you're anti-Semite. It doesn't say that you're backing Hitler. It just says that you just had to join because that was the way it was in those days. And it was a dictatorship. And Schindler was very much like that. And his going back to his early days in Zvizavi, or Zvitao, as it is now, his hometown, his next-door neighbor was a rabbi, and he used to play with the sons there, and he got along well with everybody. And because Schindler's boss, Admiral Canaris, I mean, he was very anti-Hitler. I mean, he paid for it with his life in the end. So, you see, you can be, you can support your government, or, you know, and still at the same time not agree with their racial policies, and that was really what the point of it was. But he was an extraordinary man, and Emily Schindler, I mean, she knew this. She knew what Oscar was about. She knew that he, you know, he more or less, after their marriage, I mean, he more or less carried on as a single man. And she couldn't change him, and nor did she wish to change him. And she told me this when I met her in Jerusalem in 1995. So he was an exceptional man. Yes, I agree.
And, you know, and you know, they always say exceptional people do exceptional things. And you know, the whole story behind Schindler was how he saved thousands of lives by lying to the Nazi party, more or less. He was able to use, I guess, bribery in some cases to possibly get his way to keep the people that were working for him, who were mostly Jews, out of the ghetto, the Krakow ghetto. Kept them from being deported.
That's right. I mean, he was a very high official in the German military intelligence, and this is the part of my. You see, in the Spielberg film, it commences in 1939. It doesn't tell you anything about what he did before then. Okay, in Tom Keneally's book, he does start from the beginning of his life, but he misses out probably the most important part, was his joining the German military intelligence in 1937-38. So one of the reasons why I wanted to sort this out was, firstly, not to be too critical of Spielberg or Keneally, but I just wanted to realign the story of Oscar Schindler, because it is a fascinating story, and he did it with very good intentions in mind, and yet he was at the center of Jewish destruction in Krakow, and by his acts of his rescue, and you've only got to speak to some of the people that he did rescue, and I've interviewed probably 50, 60 of them, that he was genuinely a man that felt that this shouldn't have happened. But again, there are even rescued Jews did say that he was still a Nazi for all that. So he's a very complex character, and hopefully I've been able to, in my book on him, been able to sort of set this out and let people make up their own mind, really.
Well, I can see how there would be an interest in that part of his life by you, since, you know, while, you know, you weren't in military intelligence, but you were obviously in some way, shape, or form in that field, that part of his life would be of great interest to you.
Yeah, I mean, that's it. I mean, on that time I went to Krakow when I was arrested, and I got over that, I went to the synagogue in Kazimierz, which is the old Jewish quarter, and I was talking to one of the receptionists, and I did mention, I mentioned the name Schindler. It was just one of those things that came out, and immediately a man came over to me who just happened to be passing at that time. I mean, it was incredulous. I mean, coincidence. And he came over and he said, did I hear you mention the name Schindler? And I said, well, yes. He said, my mother over here, and Rosalia Kornhauser, was with Schindler in Krakow, and he saved her, and I think you should really talk to her. And I just couldn't believe that this coincidence had happened. I'd been arrested one day, and now luck had turned, and I'd really come up with one of the actual survivors, and we sat down and we talked for a long time, and she invited me to Israel to visit her and her colleagues and friends. So that was an extraordinary coincidence, and she was a really wonderful woman. But that led on, of course, to other things. So you can see that unless you tread the streets, you won't find these things out. It's no good listening to learned professors in universities being lectured on about the Holocaust or whatever subject, or just reading in libraries about it. You've really got to go out and walk the streets and make your own investigation and research on the spot. And this is how you really pick up these unimaginable pieces of luck, really.
And you know, and we call it in synchronicities, I think, in another term in the spiritual world, because, you know, you know, when you're on a track, and I think you got on your track after that one case you were involved in, you know, things are brought to you that are supposed to guide you to where you're supposed to be, and this obviously was definitely your calling. And you know what's really interesting, Robin, because, you know, in the field of genealogy, and I want to come back to it, obviously, because that's my bag, but you know, one of the things that is so very important in the study of you know, our ancestors is timelines. And that, you know, building a timeline and being able to fill in as much of the information as you can for every period of time of an individual's life is so very important. And I think it's very interesting to me, since I have timelines on the mind right now, that you know, what you really did, and really in the research for this book, is that you really took the whole timeline and in fact, didn't leave any part out.
No, the Belzec's book, which I did, was for injustice. That was a serious attempt to realign the justice and the injustice of the Holocaust. The Schindler book is a labor of love, I can assure you. It really is. And I've met so many people. I mean, when I went to Israel, I saw Mrs. Kornhauser, and I was passed on to various other survivors, Moshe Besky, Joseph Bau, and Richard Reckin, and all these people that have been with Schindler during the wartime. And, you know, there are two aspects to this Schindler business, as far as I'm concerned, is either before Spielberg or after Spielberg. What I mean by that is before Spielberg, nobody really had taken it. I mean, it wasn't so popular, and I was able to mingle and mix and go and see people, and they would tell me their story, and they would give me photographs, and they would treat me very well indeed. And it was, you know, this is when I was collecting all the information after Spielberg, when the film came out. And I remember, just as an example, well, I won't mention any names, but a lady that I'd seen before Spielberg had given me so much wonderful information that when I went back after the film had come out, which was about 1993, I phoned her up, and she said, "Yes, Robin." She said, "I'd really love to see you again. Do come along, and you know, we'll talk." About 5 minutes later, the phone went in my hotel room in the City Hotel in Tel Aviv, and this man on the phone said, "I understand that you've been talking to my mother, and you want to come and see her." I said, "Yes," and he said, "But it's going to cost you $500." I said, "You must be joking." And he said, "Well, no." He said, "You know, this information is important." And I said, "Well, that's fine." I said, "But, you know," so I cancelled the visit. But that was the problem I had, was before it was fine. Afterwards, you know, it was very, very difficult. So that's how the investigation went. So I had to be very, very sort of careful. And when I got back, in fact, when I got back to London, I put an advertisement in the Jewish Chronicle saying that I wanted information. And a chap phoned me up, and his name was Victor Dortheimer. And from then on, I went up and saw Victor, and we became the best of friends. And we travelled Europe and Israel together, piecing together the Schindler story. So it's got its good points and it's got its bad points, but that's life. I mean, you know, so that's how it all panned out.
So, you know, you've mentioned all these people that you did interview. Is there anyone in particular that really stands out, that whose story really made a impact on you?
Well, I think the nearest, Dr. Moshe Besky, who was a judge at the courts in Jerusalem. I mean, I went and saw, he was one of my first witnesses, really. This is before, as I say, before Spielberg. So, it was very interesting to meet him. And, he had looked after Schindler after the war, and he had made collections for him. Schindler was in trouble in Germany. He was broke. He could make bankrupt. And it was Besky that organized his rescue. Where Schindler had rescued him, Besky did a reverse, and he rescued Oscar with fundings and what have you. And but, you know, it's Besky in particular, came from Poland. And we get back to Belzec again, because all of Besky's family was sent to Belzec. All the witnesses, I mean, I'm talking about Joseph Bauer and Victor Dortheimer, they all, his relatives, family, mum and dad and uncles and aunts, all finished up in Belzec. So it's important to understand what horror this brings these people when they've got to relive, when I'm talking to them about Oskar Schindler. You know, some of them reacted, you know, in different ways. It was very, very difficult at times, you know, and you had to be very, very careful. In fact, Besky was probably the closest, and he was the one who really broke the news about the Hungarian Jews being taken to Plaszow, and in fact it was so close to him that he had to take several times to come and talk about it, And these were the people, but they're all special. They really are. They're all special. But he was an exception. And unfortunately, Dr. Besky passed away 2 or 3 years ago. Victor Dortheimer, the one in London I met, he's got Joseph. They're all going now, you see. And all I can say is it's been a privilege to have known them and to put the record straight.
You know, and that's why I think it is so important, is because, you know, the last 25 years, you know, has really been some of the only times where some of the real history and the stories and, you know, where people have actually been able to connect and reconnect and find out, you know, really what happened to their family members after the war. And, you know, it's now, you know, time that these people are passing on. And there was a critical period during the 70s and 80s and through, you know, the early 2000s, where it was so important, that work be done in both this field and for those in Jewish research because of the... Yeah. The timing of
you know,
things.
You know, Susan, that I think it's becoming more prevalent now that the grandchildren are now coming along, and there's a resurgence of interest in the family side of it, the one that you're a specialist in. I get most of my emails, you know, coming from the younger generations now who want to know what happened before, you know, their grandparents. And typically I would get a message, you know, can you tell me where my grandfather was taken on a transport, and which camp were they taken to? And I get this all the time, and I answer every letter. And for your listeners' information, if anybody wants to know anything particular of what we're talking about, I'll always be pleased to hear from them, and do please give them my information that they can get in touch with me. But you see, we're talking of not only the Belzec, Sobibor, Treblinka, all these places of decimation, and it's only by communicating to these youngsters that they will ever realise, you know, the true facts, and that's a reality of life, I'm afraid.
And, you know, you and I have both traveled around Eastern Europe, and I don't know about you, but it is some of the most beautiful country I think I've ever been through. The forests and the areas where there was so much life lost and you know, really where so many of the horrors took place are just some of the most beautiful areas in the world. I've been... On every trip that I've made over there, just fascinated
It is fascinating, and my getting back to my point about walking the streets, I can remember in just north of Zamosh, south of Lublin, the small towns of Piaski and Izbica, which were the transit areas for all the Jews coming in from the continent, to be shipped off to Sobibor or Belzec. But walking down the streets in Izbica, and as I say, I found door after door, you could see where the mezuzah had been, where people had been removed, and they just painted over the framework of the doors, but the evidence was there that these were once Jewish homes. And this creates it's very sad, even for me, who's sort of on the outside. I really felt about when I saw things like this, and the synagogues in Vlodava and various other places have been turned into banks and libraries, but when you went into these buildings, the ceilings were still decorated in various Judaic drawings and paintings, and it's all very sad, and it is the world of yesterday, and I'm afraid it will never come back. And Galicia, East and West Galicia was more Polish, but the East Galicia, I'm talking about Kolomia, Tarnograd, and all up through Stanislavov and Stry, and places, was really the biggest collection of East European Jews, I think, anywhere on the continent. But it's a sad realization that this has gone now, and it is the world of yesterday. But you know, I like to my mission in life is to try and get to the truth, and I don't think I can do any more than that.
And you know, that's what is so important, and that all of us have to do is you know, find the truth. I mean, that is really the base of, you know, our existence, I think, and it is so very important. Robin, I'm going to give out a phone number in case anybody has any questions for you. We're going to continue to talk if they don't. But do you have any questions for Robin? The toll-free number is 888-815-9756. So, Robin, let's talk about what's in this new book. It's Oscar Schindler, Stepping Stone to Life. And, you know, let's focus a little bit on, we don't want to give away the book. We want you to buy the book, don't we? But let's just talk a little bit about some of the things that they may find that might be a little bit surprising.
Yeah. On the women, I'm talking about the women, Schindler's women, who were, I mean, there were 300 initially, but 297 of them eventually arrived at Brunlitz, the Brunlitz camp. And there was one woman amongst them, a Mrs. Hofstadter. Cornelian they couldn't find her on any list, Mrs. Hofstadter, and I do explain all this, and I'm not going to tell you now, but read the book and you'll know. But an interesting experience happened when I knew where, just outside of Brunlitz at a village, Schindler bought a piece of ground, and he, for a Jewish cemetery. It was just off the main Christian cemetery, but that's where were buried some of the people who had died in the camp, and Mrs. Hofstadter was one of those, and she was buried with full rites and what have you. But cutting a long story short, I just come back from Poland, and I was in London, and I was in a sort of restaurant, a sort of cafeteria place, and there was a woman sitting opposite me, and we got talking. I don't know why. I'm sure I didn't know why we got talking, but we did, you know. You know how you do. And she said, have you just come back from anywhere particular or something like that? I said, well, I've just been out to Poland, actually. I said, I've been visiting some of the camps out there, and been to Auschwitz and different places, but I was doing some research on the Schindler story. She said, that's very odd, she said, you should say that. I mean, I didn't know this woman, it was in London, I'd just come off the train, and oh dear. And she said, my aunt was with Schindler. I said, no. I said, are you sure? She said, oh yes, she said, but you know, our family have now gone to Israel and America, and we never knew what happened to her. And all these years, we thought about her, and we never knew what actually happened to her. So I said, well, what do you know? And she said, well, we know that she was with Schindler in this camp in Czechoslovakia, and that we presume that she died, you know, because she didn't survive the war and what have you. So we just got no idea. And I said to her, I said, what's her name, Mrs. Hofstadter? And you know, she fainted right in front of me.
Oh, my.
Yeah. And anyway, it's a slight exaggeration, but she came round. She said, what do you know about her? And I said, well, I know where she's buried. I said, I was there 2-3 days ago. I said, I know exactly where she's buried. And cutting a long story short again, the whole family came over from the States and Israel, and we had a special plaque and the local mayor and dignitaries, and we had a reunion at the cemetery, you know, we did our job, really, or at least I did my job, and it was just pure coincidence. And this lady is a very good friend of mine now, obviously, but it just shows you again, is you've got to get out and walk the streets, and you've got to, you know, talk to people. But there you go.
Well, it's fascinating, and I'm sure, how many people do you think you actually talked to when you were preparing
I've interviewed about 50 or 60 of the survivors throughout Europe, Israel and places, and, you know, I still contact with her, getting less and less now, of course, but the realization of it all, of what Schindler did, I mean, it's amazing, his bravery, really. I mean, he was on the line, life was on the line many times. And I'll tell you, the biggest tragedy, and which really faces you, and it really shook me rigid, was when I was at the size of the former camp in Belzec, writing up some notes, I realized for the first time that in front of me, an area of about 100 meters by 100 meters, were nearly 600,000 men, women, and children, which were there, and they're still there, Susan. And this is a tragedy, just this one situation. And Schindler certainly saved many, but I'm afraid he missed a hell of a lot, too.
Well, you know, I mean, I think just the fact that he saved one, you know, is important, because, you know, I mean, that to me is what's important, just one. But the fact that you can save thousands, and, you know, obviously it would have been nice if you could have saved millions, but, you know, the story didn't write itself in that direction.
Yeah, I agree with you.
You know, but, you know, the story needs to be told, and I think that to look at it, I think, from a different perspective, and not so much from the horror, but from, you know, the hope and the lives that were saved, and the people that, you know, were able to you know, continue and, you know, continue their lives after the war you know, really a telling story. And I think you mentioned it too, and I think there's no question that, you know, Oskar Schindler was, he took a lot of risks, in some of the things that he did. And, you know, to do that and risk your own life to save another, I think is just, very, very powerful in my opinion. Now, Robin, I know that this has been the bulk of your work and, you know, over these many years, but, you know, you work on other things too, don't you?
Yeah, well, obviously the Holocaust-related subjects. I mean, Dr. Elkes, who was the Jewish community leader in the Kovno ghetto, I've done a lot of research on him, and then there's the Radka police school, where they trained all these people to do all these horrible things, were trained, and the Ukrainians, you know, and Poland and her Jews are very close to me, and I've done my best to publicize the difficulties they had. But, you know, I do get away from Holocaust research, because I'm very interested in the Habsburg family of Austro-Hungarian Empire of turn of the 20th century, 1900s. I'm a devotee of Shakespeare, works, and I'm presently researching the Paston family of Norfolk, which is 1420 to 1510 medieval family and barons of the king and what have you. So it does relieve me. I do need that, and but it's in my blood, and I've got to thank my school teacher for that, William Foskett, from my old school. In fact, I'm giving a trophy this year, a cup, to the school for historical research. So I've repaid my debts to him. I hope I've repaid my debts to the Polish Jews and every other nationality that finished up in that place, and also, of course, to Oscar.
So, you know, of all these things, and I mean, what you've done, you've been doing this research now for 40 years. What would you say has been probably your most important personal achievement in what you've done?
I think it's exposing the injustice. I mean, it's not a single thing. It's the fact that I did this because I felt I had to do it, and I've set it out in such a way that I believe that I did my best with the man I dealt with for the crimes. I did my best for him. The prosecutor, you know, become his friend, and I've honoured his pledge. Too late for him to know. But I feel quite relaxed about it. You know, you can only do your best, can't you?
That's correct, but I think he knows.
Yeah, well,
that's my personal feeling anyway. He knows. Oskar Schindler knows. All the people that maybe you didn't get a chance to talk to, they know. And I think it's I just think it's wonderful that. You know, in one respect, Robin, I think, you know, you mentioned, and you're not Jewish, I mean, with a name like O'Neill, right?
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah, but, you know, I think it's pretty pretty amazing that someone, you know, like yourself, who, you know, really did this really not so much for what your benefit was, but for, you know, what you could do for others. And, you know, Oskar Schindler was the same way. So I kind of see both of you as two peas in a pod, so to speak. Isn't that interesting? So in any event, for the audience, Oscar's new book. All right, Robin.
You must buy the book. This is a thing.
the book is available. We are taking orders. It's available on my website, which is www.susaneking.com. And Robin, of course, is the author and the scholar and really the man behind the information. And it's quite a tale, and I think I really do encourage everybody to take a read. I think it's very important that not only do we read it from a sense of history and a sense of you know, what someone can do, but to read it in a way that you know, we understand that all of us can be extraordinary if we want to be, and we can learn and live through the lives of others, and I think that this work is one that I think is very important in understanding how people can be take the risk and do what they need to do to save the lives of in some respect, I think, innocent people. Wouldn't you say, Robin?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And I've also got to thank, of course, my number one editor, Joyce Field, who's kept me on the straight and narrow for the last 10, 15 years. And she's taught me a lot, and I'm always going to be grateful to her.
Absolutely.
And, you know, she is a fantastic person, and she's the one who should really take some of the credit for this.
Well, Joyce, I think all of us, the three of us, you, me, and Joyce, kind of share some history together over these many years. And I guess we maybe keep each other straight. How do you
absolutely,
like that?
Absolutely, yeah, it's fine. But it's lovely to talk to you, and do pass on my best wishes to everybody. And as I say, if I can help anybody out there with anything, any inquiries about the subject, do get in touch.
That's correct. And you can contact me. Do you want to give out your email address, Robin?
Yeah, it's dr.ro@btinternet.com.
Great. And any further thing you want to say about the book? Any final comments?
No. It's as I say, it's been a labor of love, and it's completed, it's done, and we'll move on.
That is great. I thank you for your time today. I know it's getting late in London. We still got the sun shining here, so we're just about finishing our midday. But in any event, thanks for being with us. And again, the book is available for orders at www.susanmeking.com. And I think that, we look forward to hearing back from people after you've had a chance to read this particular work. And I know, Robin, we're going to be seeing some more things from you in the future.
Okay. Well, good luck to
you. All right. Thank you very much. In any event, this has been a really enlightening hour, I think. We've enjoyed Robin's stories immensely. And in fact, I had to laugh when he told me about his arrest in Poland. I had a situation happen to me once. We were traveling actually from Warsaw to Belarus. And I almost got myself arrested too. And we were, for those who don't know, sometimes when you're traveling in Eastern Europe, for example, the train tracks, and especially on the trains, the wheel widths are different when you go from one country to another. So I almost got arrested myself taking pictures of watching this particular thing. So in any event, I had to laugh about that story. Again, it's been fun. Great being back live. We'll be back live again next Tuesday on Where Genealogy and Spirit Connect.
You have been listening to Where Genealogy and Spirit Connect with Susan E. King. Each week, we will focus on the spiritual journey of connecting ourselves with our ancestors. Join us every Tuesday at 11 a.m. Pacific right here on BBS Radio. For upcoming show information, you can visit Susan's website at www.susaneking.com.